Be seated, please. The court is now ready to hear argument in 070520, Ed Venegas and others versus American Energy Services and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Stroder will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I have the honor, of course, of representing a group of employees trying to recover an incentive bonus. I believe the issue basically here is whether or not the promise to pay that bonus to at-will employees is unenforceable because on the grounds that that promise is, in a sense, illusory. I, of course, am of the opinion that it is not. The appellees, of course, at trial through the Court of Appeals and here have seized on certain language in Light versus Centel. They've adopted certain passages that they believe supports their contention that the promise to pay this incentive bonus, because the employer could terminate these employees at any time, that promise was illusory and thus unenforceable. And, of course, we are of the opinion that it's illusory only in the sense, like in any kind of unilateral contract, is that the promise is revocable prior to acceptance by performance on the part of the employees. Now, my idea of what the protections of and the concept of illusory promises is that you don't want to bind somebody to perform their promise when all they get in exchange is something that is just worthless. That's not the situation here. AES got the consideration. They got the bargain for performance by the employees. And now they're trying to tell us, well, since our promise, we believe our promise is illusory and thus worthless, we don't have to perform.
What if they fired the employees the day before the sale?
Fortunately, that's not the issue here. That would be a situation where I believe at that time you'd have to look into the intent. I can't believe that the courts would allow that to happen when they just fire them without any reason, just to frustrate their entitlement to the bonuses that were promised.
Theory, but I mean, would that render the agreement illusory, though, because they had the right to do that?
No, because if I were in that situation, which fortunately I'm not here, it would not render it illusory because these people have tendered substantial performance. In fact, depending on how close it got to the date of the sale or the merger, it would be complete performance. But I would believe that some of the cases we've talked about, you know, Miller versus Riata, that at that point in time, they substantially complied with the terms of the offer and performed. So, no, it would not be illusory because they have performed. The question might be more difficult if you got, you know, halfway through the term 6 months before, then it would be I wouldn't want to be in that situation. It would be very tough to perform, I mean, to prove our case. But
kind of a sliding scale, illusory argument?
I believe there would have to be some sort of determination whether or not they've substantially performed. And then I guess, and I realize, of course, there's no implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in the employment relationship, but if you had somebody that actually fired an employee just to avoid the promise after the employee had performed, I think you would have some good faith issues that have to be addressed by the court.
But if they fired them for good reasons the day before the performance was completed?
You would have a different situation, I believe. That would be an even tougher case. It would have nothing to do with illusory, I don't believe. I believe it would have to do with whether or not the employee had substantially performed his obligations. I don't think it would affect the illusory nature of the promises one way or the other. It would go to whether or not the employee had performed.
If an employer promises to pay at-will employees a pension, can they, because they're at-will employees, renege on that promise?
Well, yes, other than there's such a thing as ERISA, of course, that wouldn't let them do that. But under the reasoning of the Venegas court, I would say certainly they could. It's just another form of compensation, deferred compensation. But like we talked about, I believe ERISA would take us out of that. I don't believe we'll be faced with that problem, although potentially there might be some sort of plan that would not be covered.
Well, vacation pay or, you know, some other form of promise, some other benefit.
Absolutely.
That would cover all of those.
Absolutely. Anything an employee would get in return for his the work he provided to the employer is compensation. Bonuses, vacation pay. I wanted to point out that the Venegas case has been looked at by a couple of sources. I think the Corbin supplement, since we wrote our briefs, has been critical of the Venegas reasoning. It's a Corbin supplement in section 1.17. It also posits a situation, as I believe I pointed out in my brief, if you hire somebody for a particular wage, $15 an hour, pick a number, and if the Venegas court is correct, that promise is illusory and they don't have to pay them that wage, despite the fact that this employee labored for a month at that wage, it would be unenforceable. And then what would you do? Are you going to go back in and litigate what the reasonable value of those services, or some sort of quantum merit theory every time? Well, Corbin points that out, and it does lead to a very untenable result, because if the promise is illusory because the employer could fire him, what would make the employer pay the agreed upon wage, even after the employee has accepted that wage by laboring under that arrangement? Both of them laboring under that arrangement. And there's also recently there's a federal case, Southern District of Texas, Talent Tree versus Madlock. It's a 2008 Westlaw 4104163. That court was presented with some pretrial rulings, but was presented with a similar situation as we had in Venegas, and that court addressed it and basically applied the its best guess at what the Texas law under Miller versus Riata had said. Of course, the bonus is payable, and they rejected Venegas, its reasoning, and tells us that, well, and they pointed to the same problems I would see. Well, what would keep an employer just reneging on his promise to pay a particular rate if it just wanted to, even though the employer had accepted it? Anyway, the court in Talent Tree was skeptical and did not follow Venegas in that particular situation, although it was waiting on him. It didn't note that this case was on appeal, and in an absence of ruling by this court, it applied previous Supreme Court law.
How much are we talking about in this case? What was the... Was it the merger with AES acquisition? Was that a sale? How much was it for? What would 5% be? How many employees are there?
Well, we've got, and there were a few more employees that along the line actually quit, or well, I think one may have been even terminated. But we have, I guess, these that we have before us left. And the amount of money that I calculated on the 5%, I guess at the time, was like $1.4 million. That would be their share of the sale of mergers. That's 5%. So we're talking about, at least in my mind, a substantial amount of money.
Now, the ones that quit before them, they wouldn't have fulfilled the condition to get paid, right?
Right.
So we're just talking about recovery for the ones that stayed through the acquisition.
Right.
There were one left, and he would get 5%?
Yes. That was the deal.
That's the problem with oral promises. Sounds kind of outrageous. I mean, if you're talking, how many employees was it at the first that this was allegedly made to?
It, These are the core people. It was basically, there might have been, like I say, two or three more, but not many more.
Which is how many?
I think we got
20, 200.
No, I'm talking about 8 or 10.
So you tell 8 or 10 people, I'll pay you 5%, and then if only one of them's left, that's your position. They get the 5%.
Absolutely. That was the employer's position. They made the promise, and it's my position at this point. Yes, sir. In short, I just don't see how the... go ahead.
You see, that doesn't look like the... assuming that promise was made, that doesn't look like the promisor got what they bargained for, which was for you all to stay. And you all, if they all but one left...
And that, well, of course, the employer did get what it's promised for. The vast majority of them did stay. That was the purpose of offering this, to get the vast majority of them to stay, and of course they did. That was the very purpose of it. again, if the mere fact that a promise, in looking to a unilateral contract, if the mere fact that the promisor can revoke that promise, makes it an illusory contract, then there's just not going to be such a thing as a unilateral contract anymore. This won't be, because all offers that include promises that are looking for acceptance by performance are revocable until they get actual performance. So if the Venegas Court is right, then all these years of us talking about unilateral contracts is just out the window.
If you prevail, I suppose the case has to go back to the Court of Appeals to consider the statute of frauds argument.
I believe the appellees have abandoned that statute of frauds argument. They did, and I haven't talked about it, they did on appeal raise for the first time that the fact that there was no new consideration, but that wasn't in the motion for summary judgment, and they're precluded from raising it at the Court of Appeals or anywhere else, in my view, because... they just didn't raise it in their motion for summary judgment where it has to be raised. And, of course, conditionally on with that assumption, I did argue that traditionally, these incentive bonuses for people to stay or work better or whatever has been considered consideration, has been upheld for years and years and years. In fact, if the Venegas Court's ruling is upheld, it's going to change an awful lot of years and years of law on bonuses, et cetera. There will be a lot of people that it will... and we'll see that a lot of these employers reneging on their promises to pay whatever, bonuses, vacation pay, any other kind of perks. That's all I have for right now.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. Mr. Estes will present argument for the respondents.
If it please the court... there are two issues at play here of great importance. One is the contract formation issue. That is, will an illusory promise form the basis for an enforceable unilateral contract? But the other issue that was disregarded in Talent Tree that Corbin didn't address and that the petitioner here does not address is the employment at will doctrine. That is the principal difference between what one case has called this bold assertion that you can never have unilateral contracts if this is right. That's the principal difference. If A hires B to work for $10 an hour, A is still free to fire B and B is still free to quit. But if he's worked an hour, he gets $10. The difference in this contract, of course, is if you stay until some merger in the future, and the record is very clear, no merger was contemplated at the time. If you stay until then I will pay you this. And as the questions and the answers have clearly pointed out, it does great damage to an important policy issue in this state, which is employment at will. That is, you would not necessarily be free to fire B. B would not necessarily be free to quit. And the court has correctly, in its questions, honed in on what the problem is with oral promises of this nature that, in fact, are based on an illusory concept or an illusory promise. This is, in fact, a contract formation case. It involves the central question of whether or not, in a continuing employment context, which is what this is, an illusory offer can constitute adequate consideration for a unilateral contract.
There's no question you employer can say, I know you've been working, but here's a new condition, and if you keep working, you accept, and that's an acceptance.
Absolutely. That's the Halliburton case and others, because they are free to quit, or you're free to fire them if they don't accept it. It does so no damage.
They accept it by the
They
employees.
Accept by showing up the next day, and it does no damage to employment at will, because they still have free will, whereas the contract such as we have here.
What would enforcing the 5%, how would that damage the employment at will?
Well, the question becomes is, if you're looking at enforcing, at the end of the day, the question becomes, can you have a contract to begin with in an employment at will contract where the promise impacts whether or not that they remain an employee at will? Are you free to fire them? And for example, I think it was clearly pointed out in the opening argument that you might not be free to fire them the day before, whether for good cause or no cause.
So we were to say if we were to hold that, yes, you are free to fire.
Right.
But the employee is not fired, they remain, and they remain based on the inducement or the incentive of this 5%. Again, how would that harm the at-will doctrine?
Well, I think it does it just in general in that it's a contract that cuts against that public policy of employment.
You're saying free to fire and free to quit. That would still remain. The employer could fire before the merger. The employee could quit. I'm saying, assuming that's what we held.
Actually, there are a lot of cases out there where there are cases that involve due consideration, but there are a lot of substantial performance cases out there, some from this court, which really does not leave you free to fire. In those cases, I think they were free to fire, but had they reached certain commission levels, you would owe them that had they substantially performed. Here, there's not really
So if we accept your principle, and if the principle is free to fire and free to quit, those freedoms remain, could we, and again, assuming that we think the fire, you know, we hold the firing would be okay, then I don't understand how enforcing that 5% promise, which we have to assume was made, in any way undermines the at-will principle.
You do have to assume that in this summary judgment case. Obviously, we deny that. But that then takes us back to the second issue, because it's not just employment at will. It's consideration, and I beg to differ. Consideration was raised in the summary judgment motion. It was raised and briefed in the Court of Appeals by both parties. But the truth of the matter is this illusory promise issue that was raised in light in certain discussions and then mentioned again in Sheshinov is in fact a consideration issue. So you go back to the second important concept, and that is, did they even have a contract?
But the problem in light was that the fellow who gave the illusory promise was trying to hold the fellow who didn't to his promise.
Right.
And this is the opposite.
Right. It is. There's no question that it makes it, it has certain facial appeal at the end of the day, but it doesn't undo the principle that's involved. And I agree that Light was not this case, but the discussion in Light was an intentional discussion. It was a lengthy discussion, and then it was raised again by this court in Sheshinov. And if the principle is that employers are free to contract with employees, they're free to contract with one another, so long as it doesn't do damage to the employment at will, then they can have a contract. And it went on to discuss the issue of unilateral contracts, and the court was fairly clear in saying, here's what would be required for such a unilateral contract, and that is a non-illusory promise that can be accepted by performance. We have here the classic example of an illusory promise, as footnote 5 in Light talked about, promise of a future raise. That's in essence what we're talking about here. Here we have a case. This is not the case of first employment. This is not a case of new consideration, which you'd see, or a case of standards, for example, in earning commissions and substantial performance. These employees were obligated to remain at work if they wanted to be paid. There was no new consideration given. There was no new duties undertaken. Nobody got a cut in pay. There were, and the Court of Appeals expressly found, based upon the record, that nothing had changed from the date of the alleged promise through then.
Couldn't an employer just simply come in and say, you know, oil's gone up to $150 a barrel, guys. We're going to raise your pay.
Sure.
Just because I want to do that.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't bind anybody. You still have an employment at will.
I think it binds the employer to pay it. It gives them the right to.
But it doesn't impair the employment at will relationship, does it? It just says if you stay, you get more money.
No, because it's not expressly dependent upon continuing employment. In other words, B could quit right then. A could fire them right then. But this agreement, as it's alleged in this case, is expressly dependent upon continued employment.
I'm just concerned. These are exceedingly common incentive promises. I mean, you know, every government in the world, if you win a gold medal at the Olympics, you get $20,000. And you're saying those are all invalid.
No,
How about judges? If you work for 20 years, you'll get a pension.
I want to.
And you're saying no. Well, you can work for 20 years, but we're not giving you a pension.
I'd
be shocked if that's the rule.
Here is the distinction. If you win a gold medal, you get $20,000. That's changed. You're still running the race. If they said you're running the race, you get $20,000, that would be different because they're already obligated to run the race. Judges' pensions, for example, would be very different because there is performance in place which says if you stay 5 years, it's this amount. If you stay 10 years, it's this amount. If you stay 20 years, it's this amount. All of those agreements.
Don't get it unless you go all the way through. And this promise just said if you stay till the merger, and they say they did. So there's nothing.
And there was no new consideration for the promise. That's really that has always been the law.
A lot of people start running and shooting archery without thinking they're without a promise for $20,000. But that doesn't make. And they'd do it even if nobody paid them. But, I mean, these are exceedingly common. People and governments all the time promise they're bonuses in every sport. If this happens, then you get it. And you're saying, well, you know, because somebody could quit early, none of those are enforceable.
But all of those relate to some sort of specific performance. If you sell 20 cars instead of just stand at the car lot, you get a bonus. That's different. It's tied to the performance, not to the continuing time of the performance.
So the problem here is that he just said if you stay with the company and work till a merger, you get paid, but they had to do better work than they'd been doing before.
No.
It would have been enforceable.
No, that is the problem. They didn't have to do anything different other than that which they were already obligated to do. That's
my understanding was is they had made rumblings that they wanted to leave. They were unhappy. Their equipment was out of date. And so to entice them to stay.
You might gain that understanding from the briefs. You won't gain it from the record. The record.
That may. I mean, you may win on that.
The record is
summary judgment. And
right.
We've got to assume they'll be able to prove that.
I'm talking about the record in this case, though. Agreement that is alleged.
But would
is
that
very
make a
simple.
Difference? Would it make a difference if the record, if on at trial they were to show that you had some unhappy employees and you know, to entice them to stay, the employer said, "Well, we'll cut you in on a deal if we sell."
No, I don't think so. I think if they are obligated to stay, they're free to quit. They're free.
We're obligated to stay.
They're not obligated to stay. That's the whole point.
Why wouldn't they're agreeing to kind of yield or give up their right to leave when they otherwise would? Why isn't that itself consideration?
Well, I think that because nothing new of value has been offered.
Nothing new of value was offered in Halliburton.
But in Halliburton, the difference was it's not expressly dependent upon continued employment. The record here is not that these employees quit and were brought back and the promise of this bonus. The record here is that allegedly a promise was made. If you stay, someday in the future, if and when we ever sell, you get 5%. And it really goes back, and I understand it's kind of like how many angels dance on the head of a needle, but it really does go back to the contract formation issue. Does that promise have any meaning? It has some appeal after the fact to say, boy, it would be nice if it did. But from a policy perspective, did they have a contract on that date? I think that the applicable contract law would say no, that they didn't.
Let me give you a couple of examples so I can make sure I understand your position. If there's a runner who's going to run a 5K race, and the sponsors are there, and he comes to me and says, Wainwright, I'm going to run this. Will you agree to give me $500 for charity, my favorite charity, when I finish? And I say yes. He runs, finishes. Am I obligated to pay him the $500?
Probably not. It's a gratuity, as you've described it. It's easy to say bonuses are not gratuities, and there's lots of cases that say that, but you have to look at the facts of the specific case to determine whether there's bargain for consideration or gratuity.
Well, let's take the charity out of it then. He's going to run 5K, but he's only going to run it if I give him $500. I say, okay, he runs it, finishes, says, where's my $500? Does he win?
If that was the bargain for consideration, was the $500, and that was the deal from the beginning, presumably so, that then would not be a gratuity.
So in my example, he can come to me and compel me to pay him the $500.
In the second example, yes. In the first example, no, if I followed it correctly.
Okay, let me change it a little bit more to make sure I understand the contours of your argument. If he comes to me and says, I'm going to run this 5K race, and will you pay me $500 if I finish? And I say yes, and he says, oh, by the way, my sponsor's also paying me $1,000, but I'm going to run it anyway to get another $500 from you. I would have run it even if you weren't paying me $500. He runs the race, finishes it, comes to see me and says, where's my $500? Does he win?
I'm not sure I really see what the consideration would be there with a stranger to the original contract. And I'm getting a little bit...
Let me make sure I understand. Does he win? Does he get the $500 from me under your understanding?
If he's
being paid $1,000 by somebody else.
If there was consideration from your side, he's already obligated to run the race, but there's additional and different consideration from another party. I apologize, Justice Wainwright. I'm not sure.
Okay. I'm trying to get closer and closer to your fact situation,
right,
which is the employees, by staying there, got paid anyway.
Right.
And you say the 5% is just illusory.
Right.
In my example, is my $500 illusory?
I think probably so. In your example, of course, it comes from a third party, and that would be if an investor of the company came in and said, I'll give you an extra $500 if you'll stay, then it's a closer call. But in this particular case, they are already obligated to work.
What if they had quit? What if they had that morning said, we're done, we're out of here, we're going to quit, and they said, hang on, if you stay, then different case?
It certainly could have been a different case had they quit that morning. Now, would they have stayed just for a promise of the future dependent upon future employment? It might have been a raise, it might have been new equipment, it might have been whatever the new consideration would be. But the problem with these alleged oral agreements that are just kind of pie in the sky way out there in the future, they were going to quit if we didn't keep paying them. They had every right to quit if we didn't keep paying them.
I understand your argument. Raises wouldn't be enforceable either.
I'm sorry?
No raises would be enforceable. You're already working for a company. They say, we like your work, we're going to give you a raise. It's unenforceable because all you're doing is still working.
No, because the promise of a raise presently is not dependent upon continued employment. It's due every day that you show up and every day that you work. But if I promised you a raise, if you stay with me a year, you'll get a raise at the end of the year.
Ah, and that's an unenforceable. That bonuses?
It certainly could be unenforceable because the promise is dependent upon continued employment, expressly dependent upon continued employment. And that's the very language in Light and Sheshinoff that we rely on.
Well, I mean, I understand the problem with this agreement with, you know, we'll give you 5% of something that none of us have in mind what that'll be and whether it's right. Oral contracts. But if you're asking us to declare all year-end bonuses illegal in Texas, there's going to be a firestorm.
Well, that actually raises a very good example. Our staff expects a Christmas bonus. Our staff can't sue us for that Christmas.
But you've never promised them a specific amount. A lot of people promise specific amounts of bonuses, and you're saying none of them are in year-end bonuses are unenforceable.
Most of those type bonuses in practice and in reality are in fact gratuity bonuses as opposed to performance-based bonuses. The difference, the distinction I would draw, if you stay and, oh, by the way, you meet this performance goal this month, this performance goal this month, then forthcoming is the bonus, because the new consideration, besides just the obligation you have to work for me, is meeting certain performance goals.
But what if you promised them in February, if you're here on December 31st, we pay bonuses and you'll get a bonus?
I think that in all likelihood is an illusory promise. I really don't think that does any damage, number one, to the old law as it relates to new consideration, and I certainly don't think it does any damage to what is a sensible rule when you interplay it with employment at will that was discussed and raised in Light in the footnote.
But an employee could act to his or her detriment on the assumption that promise is going to be fulfilled.
They could, and they have a remedy for that, but that remedy doesn't necessarily depend on a formed contract or a contract based on an illusory offer in a unilateral contract sense. They certainly, if they rely on it to their detriment, would have a promissory estoppel type claim, a misrepresentation claim, or a fraud claim. But that's not the case here. The important, I think, thing for the jurisprudence of this state is for parties to understand what does it take in a continuing employment case, given the employment at will doctrine, to have a unilateral contract that will be enforceable. And I would suggest, much like the question in the earlier case, if you want to see a flood of cases, make it easy, because that does then become easy, because you can make up any pie in the sky promise and say, oh, I was still here the day I quit, and we have a contract. You have to have standards, and I think that this court laid out standards in both Light and Sheshinoff. It's been followed by not only the Venegas court in Eastland, but by the Tyler court, and frankly, the Tyler court going the other direction. And whether you like those results or not, at least it's based upon stable and well-recognized law that everybody knows and everybody can live with.
Let me ask you, counsel,
and the Houston First Court.
As your time is concluding here, sure. Conceptually, you said we don't want to do damage to the at-will doctrine.
Right.
Free to quit. Free to file.
Right.
And certainly that's the premise for employment here in Texas.
Right.
What's wrong with parties agreeing to something that changes that?
I don't.
Why can't they agree to a contract, unilateral or bilateral? Bilateral you don't have a problem with, right. But unilateral ones at issue here. Why can't they just agree to something that's different? So conceptually, there's no damage to at will being done. The parties are just agreeing to modify it to some degree.
They can, so long as the offer in the unilateral contract is non-illusory. But if it in fact
offers in unilateral contracts illusory?
You know, they're really not.
Paint my house and I'll give you $100.
One of these cases referred to that as the bold assertion. They boldly assert that anything that you could revoke would be illusory, and that simply isn't true. The agreement to come to work for me tomorrow is not illusory if you come to work and I pay you for that day's work. You're free to come and go the following day. The difference is that a promise projected way out in the future, such as a promise of a future raise, the promise of a future bonus, or a hybrid promise such as this, the promise at the very outset is illusory. You had no contract. Now, if what they said was true, they had other remedies. The court has already pointed out they could sue for fraud. They could sue for misrepresentation, fraud in the inducement in the original contract. But the issue of importance to the jurisprudence of this state, I think, is in a continuing employment context, for such a promise to be enforceable, will it have to be a non-illusory promise? I appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Of course, the appellants are not arguing that we want to destroy the employment at will doctrine. And as y'all have clearly pointed out, paying an agreed upon bonus does nothing to the at will doctrine. The employer is free to fire the employee. The employees are free to quit. What the employer is not free to do is not pay the compensation that he agreed upon. He's not free to do that. They're two separate considerations here. And again, Mr.
Counsel, is respondent saying that employment is different? Maybe different from charity running race, maybe different from if you paint my house, I give you $100. There's no employee-employee relationship there. Employment is different because you're getting paid to come to work anyway. Conceptually answer that argument. And don't talk about the whole world being changed. Focus on employment. He says it's different.
I don't know how it's different than contract law. The employment relationship basically is contract law. Either you can have bilateral agreements, or you can have I'll pay you a particular wage, and you work, and then you get paid that wage.
And he doesn't disagree with any of what you just said.
True. I'm not sure whether he's talking about new consideration, which wasn't raised in the summary judgment motion. It just wasn't.
We've got the record. We'll look
right
at that.
And if he's trying to merge the two here, and I don't think successfully so, because he's trying to argue that there needs to be new consideration in this situation, and I don't believe so. The cases are rampant where these people, for incentive to an employee to remain at work for a stated period, either a year or some event, they've been upheld. So I think it's basic contract law. I don't know that employee-employer relationships, which is based upon contract, is different at all in that sense. The at-will doctrine, I don't know that has anything to do with contract law other than absent an agreement to the contrary, you can fire or you can quit at will. So I don't think there's really it, and the employment relationship is a contractual relationship. It just simply is, as pointed out by all the Hornbook people, the Corbin. They talk about it's basically a unilateral situation. In most situations, it's a unilateral agreement. You come to work, I'll pay you a wage. Same thing with a bonus, as Corbin points out. You stay till X date, I'll pay you a bonus. Same situation. And I'm not sure whether I answered your question or not. Maybe I didn't. I'm trying to. But, no, I believe it's a contractual relationship. All the considerations apply.
This is it?
I have
my time over. Okay. Just one other thing I think.
He's done. I don't know.
One other thing, I wanted to make sure, and I realize y'all understand.
You can interrupt them.
Light was a non-compete case, and it was, and you have that the statute, of course, came into play. And when they started talking about, well, you can't have an agreement to pay a raise in the future, they were talking in that context because you had to have a bilateral agreement, and that's what Light was dealt with. Light did not intend to turn on its head the law of contracts, but what the appellees have done is cut and pasted particular phrases that I don't blame them. I mean, it makes it helps them. But they've cut and pasted particular phrases, but it just does not make logical sense. It just would lead to untenable results, and I pray this court to reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Justice Heck has a question.
I've got one other question.
Oh,
Mr. Estes, I'm sorry. Was this Has the statute of frauds argument been abandoned by the respondent?
Your Honor, the agreement as alleged on its face in the current record could have been performed within 1 year had a sale or merger occurred in 1 year.
Thank you.
No.
It has for the time being been abandoned.
Yes. Thank you.
So the cause has been submitted, and the court will take a brief recess. Thank you, counsel.